Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I'm delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Peter Kuznick, who is an associate professor of history at American University and the director of the Nuclear Studies Institute there at American University in Washington, D.C., where one of the courses he teaches is called Oliver Stone's America. Peter Kuznick and Oliver Stone have authored and created a book and a series that is airing on Showtime around the world called The Untold History of the United States, an amazing production. Kuznick and Stone also are planning an upcoming trip to Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Tokyo, and Okinawa. We will discuss all of these topics. Peter Kuznick, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks, David. Very glad to be here.
It's an amazing book, The Untold History of the United States. I suppose now it is told, as long as people keep reading it and watching the show on Showtime. What sort of response have you been getting?
We've been getting a very positive response, overwhelmingly positive. We have our critics. We have the hardline right-wingers who hate what we're doing, people like Ron Radosh. Ron recently attended, we were the keynote feature speakers at the Popular Culture Association annual conference in Washington, D.C. last month, and it was a very big session, and Ron apparently screaming in the back of the room. We couldn't quite hear what it was. They threw him out. Then he wrote an article complaining that we were treated as conquering heroes, were his words, by the historians and the scholars at the Popular Culture Association. And then he had a session that was criticizing us, and he said, and nobody came to his session. So he was not very happy. We also get criticized by some of the Cold War liberals, people like Sean Wilentz, strong supporter of Bill and Hillary Clinton. The Cold War liberals, the people who brought us Vietnam and are now bringing us much of what's happening in the world today in the Obama administration, also don't like what we're saying. But the response from the public and the response around the world has been extraordinary. I recently did an interview with the editor of Turkey's Journal of American Studies, and he said that Untold History has gone viral in Turkey. We actually were not totally caught off guard by the demonstrations, the eruption in Turkey, and the protest movement. We had a sense that there was a lot of ferment there, but we're airing in much of the world. The book is out in the process of coming out in Chinese, Russian, German, French, Japanese, Bulgarian, and the documents are airing pretty much everywhere. We finally just got a big breakthrough in Latin America because that had been slow. So it's been very, very positive and very exciting so far.
It's a tremendous accomplishment. I've watched a few of the episodes, which are absolutely wonderful. But I'm a book reader. I like the book better, and that was a foregone conclusion. And the book is full of incidents from U.S. history that I was completely unaware of, and others that I was aware of, but that are very infrequently told and are told here very, very well. One of those was the Wall Street push of 1934. For those unfamiliar, could you explain briefly what happened there?
There were a few things going on. Roosevelt outraged the conservatives and the Wall Street interests, and they fought back, as they often do. There was the Liberty League. These were right-wing forces around the DuPonts and the Morgans. And by that point, Al Smith had gone over and joined them, and they got together and they approached Marine General Smedley Butler, who was one of the most highly, at the time, the most highly decorated Marine in American history up to that point. And they approached him and wanted him to lead a right-wing coup, pretty much a fascist coup, against the Roosevelt administration. Butler exposed this. There were congressional hearings. The chair of the congressional committee said that all of Butler's allegations had been borne out by the evidence that was presented to the committee, but this effort was thwarted. I mean, the right wing has been active. Even in the 1930s, when the right wing seemed to be pretty much wiped out in the United States, there was very little support for Hitler and those fascist elements. There was, however, as we talk about in the book and in one of the episodes in the documentary, there was a strong Wall Street element that maintained ties with German business. We were somewhat surprised, the more we studied this, to see how long they held on. They held on long after the odious nature, the horrible nature of the Hitler regime was quite well known. And in fact, some of the companies actually began converting to wartime production in Germany, but refused to do so in the United States during this period. So they continued, they maintained their control until 1941 of their subsidiaries in Germany. But then they ran them through some of the same people who had run them earlier for the United States, U.S. companies, Wall Street firms, now ran them for the German government. And the profits were held and then returned to the U.S. companies after the war. In fact, some of the American companies actually got damages from the U.S. government when their factories were bombed by the United States during the war and destroyed. They actually sued and got damages after the war.
And this really was untold history, right? These were things that were going on of significance to U.S. foreign policy, connections to major stories in the news and in history as it began to be told. But the congressional investigation of this attempted coup was rather hushed up, and nothing much came of it. And history books in the 50s and 60s and so forth certainly didn't feature this episode.
Yes, it's been pretty much forgotten by historians, because we don't have the records, the congressional records, the testimony. A lot of that has disappeared. We haven't been able to track down enough hard information to actually make the definitive case as we can with other topics. And Smedley Butler is a very interesting figure, but he's also somebody who's been pretty much lost to history. He made those brilliant comments about being a muscle man for Wall Street. He talked about all the places he and the Marines intervened on behalf of the American bankers and American business interests throughout Latin America, in China, in the Philippines, and other places. He was involved in all of those interventions, repeated one country after another, which we show in one of the episodes also. If you put that up on a map, and you show the number of countries the United States intervened and invaded in Latin America, Central America during that period, it really is stunning. That's why it's, for me as a historian who writes books, to actually combine this with Oliver Stone and his talents to make things so visually compelling is what brings the documentaries to life. Among the criticisms we've gotten, nobody's ever said it when they were boring. Even our critics concede the fact that this is absolutely riveting, which is why we would love to get it into the schools, because this would be a way to overcome some students' boredom and to teach them a lot of history in a manner that is actually enjoyable, because each of these episodes feels like a feature film. Oliver directed them that way. They build up, there's a crescendo, there's a peak, there's a climax, there's excitement building, but everything is factual. We've fact-checked this stuff 3 times. Corporate fact-checks, Showtime fact-checks, because the goal is to make the strongest case for an alternative vision of America, to refute American exceptionalism, to show how close the United States has come many times to following a different course in history, in which history could have been fundamentally different. We don't want people to come away from this saying, oh, God, there's nothing we can do. They're so strong, they're so powerful, they're so smart. There's no point even organizing and protesting. What we see this as is really a primer for organizers. This is the tool, the weapon that we want organizers in the United States, the left, the progressives, to be understanding and to be using in order to educate the public. Our basic assumption is that everybody has a sense of history. It might not be a fully articulated, consistent sense of history, but every individual has a sense of history. And that understanding of history, in large part, shapes how they act in the present. So we think history is definitely worth fighting over. And we think that the way history has been presented over the years gives people little... It has undermined people's sense of utopianism, the sense that history turned out the way it inevitably had to, and we're the good guys and we won, and we're doing God's work in the world, has undermined the people's ability to think and understand how different the world could be now, how differently history could have turned out. And we show a lot of those episodes as well.
We're speaking with Peter Kuznick, who together with Oliver Stone created the series airing now on Showtime, The Untold History of the United States, as well as the book by the same title. Major General Smedley Butler, the speech you referred to, Peter, of course, was called War is a Racket, and I still highly recommend it to everyone. Were you aware that Smedley Butler has something in common with Bradley Manning, having been incarcerated at Quantico?
Yes. I never made that connection before.
Do you remember what they locked him up for?
Tell me again.
For publicly stating that Benito Mussolini ran over a little girl with his car and kept driving, which, of course, was not good for U.S. relations with our friend Benito Mussolini.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's shameful.
Rather embarrassing but in many ways. Another one of the stories that, of course, I had heard of, as everyone in the world had heard of, that's told in your book, is that of the nuclear bombs being dropped on two cities in Japan. But I thought that it was better told, that the decision-making process was a better account than I had seen anywhere else. We don't have time for the whole thing. Everyone should read the book. But can you briefly summarize?
I'll just put in a quick pitch, because as director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, I take students on a study abroad class every summer to Hiroshima and Nagasaki from July 30th to August 11th. And this summer, Oliver Stone is actually coming with us, because we're going to be doing a lot of public events, because our documentaries are airing in Japan to great fanfare, and our book is out actually in 3 volumes in Japanese. So if any of the listeners are interested in joining us, they should get in touch with me at American University, because we do take people who are not full-time students at American University with us. My students sometimes sit through a 12-hour lecture about the decision to drop the bomb, so it's hard to boil it down. But the reality was, the official story is that the United States dropped the bomb in order to avoid an invasion. And if the United States had to invade in order to defeat Japan, the numbers vary. Truman, in his memoirs, says that Marshall told him that we would have lost 500,000 men in invasion. The numbers keep rising over the years. Initially, Truman said thousands. Then up to 500,000. Another time he said 1 million. George H.W. Bush said we would have lost thousands, millions of American men had we invaded Japan. That's the triumphal narrative. We reject that entirely. There was not going to be an invasion of Japan. In fact, the Japanese understood that they were defeated as early as July of 1944 after the Battle of Saipan. From that point on, their Ketsugo strategy was to try, they had a twofold strategy. Militarily, they wanted hold off until one more major victory, and then attempt to get a peace settlement so they can get better surrender terms. Their other strategy was to induce an American invasion, inflict so many casualties on the Americans that they would get better surrender terms. Their diplomatic strategy, which they adopt in May, is to try to get the Soviets to intervene on their behalf to get them better surrender terms. In exchange, they're going to give concessions to the Soviets. The Japanese did not know that the Soviet Union had promised to come into the Pacific War 3 months after the end of the war in Europe. They didn't know that. So their diplomatic strategy was a complete failure as a result. The big concern for the Japanese was the emperor. The emperor to them was a god. They didn't want to see the emperor tried as a war criminal and executed. The United States knew that. We knew that that was the main stumbling block to ending the war, because we had broken the Japanese codes and were intercepting their cables. Truman himself refers to the July 18th cable as the telegram from the Jap emperor asking for peace. We knew they were trying to surrender. We had the records on that, and Truman and everybody around him commented to that effect. But the emperor was the big stumbling block. There was one other factor coming into play, two other factors coming into play. One was the atomic bomb. We tested the first atomic bomb at Alamogordo on July 16th. There was another factor coming into play, and that's that the Soviet Union had promised to come into the war. Truman said he went to Potsdam in mid-July in order to make sure that Stalin's coming into the war. So that was the main thing. And we knew, if you look at American intelligence, American reports were consistently that Soviet entry into the war will convince all Japanese that defeat is inevitable and induce Japanese surrender. Truman writes from Potsdam on July 17th, says Stalin will be in the Jap war by August 15th, Finny Japs when that occurs. Truman was explicit about that. He said that on other occasions also. that as soon as the Soviets come in, the war is over. So we knew the Soviets were about to come in. Why do we drop the bomb on August 6th and drop the second bomb on August 9th? It was not for the military reasons that are officially stated, because the Soviet Union, what actually ends the war, is not the atomic bomb, it's the Soviet invasion. From the standpoint of the Japanese leaders, the United States had already firebombed over 100 Japanese cities. The destruction had reached 99.5% in the city of Toyama. From the Japanese leader's standpoint, the United States had already proved that it could wipe out Japanese cities. The new element here was the Soviet invasion. Why that was so significant was because that showed the bankruptcy of Japan's diplomatic strategy to try to get better surrender terms through the Soviets, and it showed the bankruptcy of their military strategy, because the Soviet Red Army immediately blitzes through the Kwantung Army in Manchuria, the best Japanese army. And as Prime Minister Suzuki says, when he was asked why they had to surrender so quickly after that point, he says, now they're in South Sakhalin, they're in the Kuril Islands, they're in Manchuria, tomorrow they'll be in Hokkaido, Japan will be finished as a nation once that happened. So they thought that if they surrendered quickly to the Americans, they had a chance of keeping the emperor and getting better surrender terms. They feared the Soviets, partly because they saw what happened in Eastern Europe, and in Europe, where there were spontaneous popular uprisings in support of the Soviet troops when they came in initially, and the Japanese leaders were afraid of communist revolution in Japan. So there's a lot more to this story, but it's very important to point out that six of America's five-star admirals and generals who got their fifth star during the war are on record as having said that the atomic bombings were either militarily unnecessary or morally reprehensible, including Admiral Leahy, who chaired the meetings of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and was Truman's personal chief of staff. And he categorized it, he said, they said it was an act of barbarism on the part of the United States to do this. Eisenhower felt the same way. Douglas MacArthur, who's hardly a pacifist in most people's book, Douglas MacArthur said to former President Hoover, he said that if the government had taken your advice and told the Japanese they could keep the emperor, the war would have ended in May, according to MacArthur. He says, I have no doubt about it. I think that's premature, but I think certainly, possibly in June, and certainly by July, if the Japanese knew they could keep the emperor, they would have surrendered at that point.
When the decision-making process by President Truman is analyzed, typically there's an attempt to figure out how he calculated the good outweighing the bad. But Truman, to my mind, was such a vicious racist that I'm not sure there was a bad in the calculation in his head, that I'm not sure that killing all of those Japanese people wasn't part of the pro side of the pro-con calculation.
And it's interesting in a couple ways. Truman was a notoriously racist. He was also anti-Semitic. He was bigoted across the board. According to his biographer, who's very favorable toward him, he says Truman, in private in conversation with him, never used any word other than nigger to refer to African Americans. He also referred to kikes. And he says at one point, he writes a letter to Bess when he's courting her, and he talks about Uncle Will, talks about the Chinese and the Japs. He says he hates Chinese and Japs, so do I. And it goes on like that. So Truman was a very bigoted individual. When the atomic bomb was dropped, he was aboard the USS Augusta on his way back to the United States, and he got the news that Hiroshima had been wiped off the map. And he jumps up and screams, "This is the greatest thing in history." You don't get much of a sense of any kind of sympathy with the Japanese until after two bombs are dropped, and then he makes a comment at a cabinet meeting that Henry Wallace records, saying that he didn't want any more bombs dropped without his approval. He hated to see all those women and children killed. Truman is not bloodthirsty in that sense, but he certainly didn't seem to have any misgivings about wiping out Japanese cities. Nor did other Americans at the time. Even Secretary of War Stimson said to Robert Oppenheimer at one point, he said, "There's no protest in the country." He says, "What does that say to you? We're firebombing and wiping out these Japanese cities, and there's no protest." He said, "I won't agree with it, but people should at least be showing some kind of human concern for this." And Dwight MacDonald, the left-wing, then more moderate commentator, said at one point, he said, "King Mithridates was said to have immunized himself against poison by taking small doses and slowly building up. And he talked about the fact that people were shocked, horrified by the killing of hundreds in the bombing of Barcelona. He said the hundreds in Barcelona went up to the thousands in Dresden and the tens of thousands, the hundreds of thousands. He goes through it. And the bombing of Tokyo, 100,000 killed in the firebombing of Tokyo. And he said, you don't hear any protest. He said, it's as if we as a nation have become a moral Mithridates, immunized against human sympathy. And that, and Truman was very much part of that during this time. There wasn't protest against the firebombing of the cities. And then the next step is going to be the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What changes here with the atomic bombing, I argue, is that now, for the first time, we have begun to actually reach the point where we can end life on the planet. And part of my critique of Truman is that he knew that. And he says that on three occasions. He knows this is not just a more powerful bomb. He knows he's beginning the process that could lead to the annihilation of the species. He says, after he gets the briefing of how powerful the bomb test was in Alamogordo, he says, this may be the fire destruction prophesied in the Euphrates Valley era after Noah and his fabulous ark. And he says things to that effect on other occasions also. So the fact that he would use the bomb when there was no military justification, certainly no moral justification, and knowing the process he was beginning, what he was opening the door to me, is almost mind-boggling. The scientists had warned about it. Robert Oppenheimer told almost all the top leaders at a meeting of the interim committee on May 31st, he said that within the next 3 years, we're going to have bombs up to 7,000 times as powerful as the bomb that was used at Hiroshima. And that was within 3 years. They knew this. This is what Edward Teller was pushing for all along, the fusion bomb, the hydrogen bomb, the super bomb. The insanity of it is that in 1954, Teller was proposing an Operation Sundial, building a bomb that was actually 700,000 times as powerful as the Hiroshima bomb. LeMay said he wanted to build a bomb, one bomb of which could destroy the entire Soviet Union. This was the kind of mentality. There were congressional hearings about the Teller proposal in 1954. We were seriously considering building a bomb 700,000 times the size of the Hiroshima bomb. It was insanity.
And yet there's this notion that because it's us, because even you, Peter, used the term we when discussing the U.S. government, because we are doing these things, it's okay. If it were a different nation, if it were some other people, you know, when the recent NSA spying stories broke, talk show host Bill Maher remarked that he wanted the U.S. government to spy on him because there are nuclear weapons in the world and there are crazy Muslims in the world. Because fear of Muslim nukes, he wants the only government that's ever used the things, the only government that threatens to use the things, the government with the most stocked in a pile, to spy on him. Is this view of the U.S. as sort of a force that will permit any evil in the name of a higher good not exactly what this retelling of history is aimed at?
That's the point of our criticism of American exceptionalism.
Right.
This idea that the United States is somehow different, that the United States is somehow better, that other countries are venal and corrupt and motivated by desire for territory and power and economic wealth, but the United States is different. The United States only gets involved because we believe in spreading freedom and democracy. We're benevolent and altruistic, and we're different from everybody else. That's a crazy idea. That's such a dangerous notion. The 58% of Americans believe that God has given the United States a special mission in the world. Such a dangerous idea. That's why we show the history of the United States. We trace it back. We would have gone back earlier, but we ran out of time. But we trace it back to the late 19th century. And the key turning point initially is the Spanish-American War. And the United States intervenes in the Philippines to overthrow the popular Aguinaldo government there. And we're beginning to shift and become the leading proponent of counter-revolution in the world. So we go from being a country born in revolution that supported reform and revolutionary movements around the world to becoming the world's leading counter-revolutionary force. And we show with World War I, World War II, and then the interventions. In our narrative is a narrative that talks about Guatemala, talks about the overthrowing of Mossadegh in Iran. When we deal with Vietnam, for example, we've got, of course, a scathing critique of Vietnam, but what we do is we put it in context. We put it in the context of Brazil, of the intervention into the Dominican Republic, the slaughter of a million people in Indonesia, U.S. invasion or the U.S. overthrow of the Allende in Chile. We put Vietnam in the context so that people understand that Vietnam was not an aberration, that Vietnam was not an exception, that Vietnam was just the bloodiest example of what we were doing all over the world. I often ask my students and other people and audiences, how many Vietnamese died in the war? And it's interesting because the numbers I usually get are between 100,000 Vietnamese and 500,000 Vietnamese died in the war. Then I ask my students, how many Jews died in the Holocaust? And every hand goes up. Everybody knows the number is 6 million. And I tell them that Robert McNamara came into my class and said he accepts now that 3.8 million Vietnamese died in the war. 3.8 million. And most students and others believe, the ones who are better educated sometimes guess 1 million died in Vietnam. So I ask them, how would you feel if the average German student thought that 500,000 to 1 million Jews died in the Holocaust? You'd be horrified. You think that the Germans had covered up their crimes, that they had whitewashed and sanitized their history. But how do we feel that Americans have no idea of the magnitude of the atrocities committed by their own government? You look at the Vietnam Memorial. Powerful, beautiful. Everybody goes there and feels so moved. What's the message? What do you have there? You've got the names of 58,252 Americans who died in Vietnam. The message there is that the tragedy of Vietnam is that 58,252 Americans died. Yeah, that's tragic. But what would the message be if they also included the names of 3.8 million Vietnamese, over 1 million Cambodians and Laotians? That would be a real war memorial that would have a message about the horrors of war. The Okinawa War Memorial does that. As you know, it has the names of the Okinawans who died, the Japanese who died, and the Americans who died. That's making a very, very different statement than the Vietnam Memorial and the most war memorials around the world.
It's an incredibly important point, and one that is similar to countless incredibly important points that are made in the untold history of the United States, both the book and the film. Peter Kuznick from American University, he's an associate professor of history. He is the director of the Nuclear Studies Institute, planning a trip this August with Oliver Stone and his students to Japan. Find out more. We'll have all the links on the website of Talk Nation Radio. Peter, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. Anytime.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.